So this whole idea of why I'm doing this, you have to understand why this is important to me. To understand that, you need to go look at my story of what happened when I first went to London back in 1992 with my wife, Judy. I started going down to Speaker's Corner because that is the place where you learn what the Muslims are saying and you learn how to engage them and you hear what their best material is. And you are then able to come up with rebuttals to that. 1992, I started going down there and I realized that all I had was apologetics. I didn't really have any polemics. And for those of you who don't know what I mean by polemics, it's going on the offense. Apologetics would be defense. Polemics would be offense. So I was there to confront Islam. Speaker's Corner in London, there at Hyde Park, is the only place left in the world where you can do that publicly. You're not permitted to do this in any other country, in any other place, not even in Britain, except for Speaker's Corner there in London. So it's a perfect venue for just doing that. And so I began my polemics by the bitsomp. What we mean by this is by the seat of my pants, or as we say in Britain, by the seat of our trousers, because there's just no other book. There is no other course. There's no other people that teach it. So we had to learn it really off the cuff. In 1994, then, I took a course from Dr. Gerald Hotting, who you can see pictured there at the School of Oriental African Studies, on the origins of Islam. And he opened up an entire new area that I had never heard about. Much of that I'm going to be introducing today. And this began, my discovery of the whole historical critique of Islam. Now, look at the date, 1994. We're talking about 30 years ago. So I've been working on this for 30 years. This is not new for me. It'll be new for you, but it's not new for me and a few others, including especially the academia there in United Kingdom. In 1995, I then was asked by Muslims to debate Dr. Jamal Badawi on the Quran at Cambridge University. Now, I'd never done any debates before, so this is my first debate. And I gave 10 historical challenges at that debate. He could not respond to one of them. And I realized that this is amazing, because the best that they had in the world at that time on the Quran, if he had done 300 videos on the Quran and he could not respond to one of these challenges, I realized we had material that the Muslims would not be able to handle. Unfortunately, this was not agreed by most people, most of the church there in England. Colin Chapman, a good friend of mine, asked me to do a debate about this material. And so we had a debate in 1997 at Sully Oaks College in Birmingham, only with Christian academics and Christian missionaries were permitted to come to that debate. So it was an in-house debate. We had 50 in there at Sully Oaks College in 1997. And I debated Dr. David Marshall. Yes, that's what I looked like back then when I was trying to do my incarnational approach. And this was a debate on whether or not two topics, whether or not we should use polemics with Muslims or whether or not we should employ historical criticism. So that was in 1997. We had this debate for 2 hours. I said, yes, we should use polemics, and yes, we should use historical criticism. Dr. David Marshall, who got his doctorate there at Cambridge University on the Quran, said no to both of them. Now, at the end of the debate, we asked for a show of hands as to who stood with him, who stood with me. 25 went with him, and 25 went with me. Who do you think went with him? The academics all went with him, and all the missionaries came with me. Now, I couldn't understand that. And on the way home, Dr. Peter Riddell, who you can see there at the bottom, who then became later my mentor I did my work under him for my PhD. He explained it on the car going back to London. He said, Jay, the reason why academics can't go with you is because this material is so damaging and it's so confrontational and so controversial. That there is no way that we could use this in an academic environment, especially in Britain and in Europe, because there are many Muslims on staff with us, and this would cause so much infighting within the academy. Therefore, no academic will use this material. But you, as a missionary on the ground, out in the streets, not representing any institution or representing any chair to protect, you don't have a chair to protect. You can use it. You have the freedoms to do so. Please, for heaven's sakes, continue to do so. And it was so good for Dr. Riddell to explain that to me. And that's where the penny dropped back in 1997. And that's why I haven't stopped since 1997. I've been using this ever since. Why exactly the historical critique? You know, here is its value. Number one, it confronts the very foundations of Islam. You're going to see that today. We're going to confront the book, The Man and the Place. I've added the place as well. The book would be the Quran, the man would be Muhammad, and the place, Mecca. And I'm going to confront their historicity. I'm going to confront their existence. Just that phrase right there, to suggest that Muhammad did not exist, to suggest that that Mecca did not exist, and to suggest that the book, the Quran, did not exist in the 7th century, is highly controversial and highly confrontational. So you can understand why academics don't want to touch this. Interestingly, it's neutral. Anybody can use what I'm going to teach today. All of you can use it. It's also politically correct. This is not hate speech. This has nothing to do with Islamophobia. It doesn't attack Muslims, because I'm not going to say anything against Muslims. It is not seen as hate speech. It is not Islamophobic at all. I'm not getting any strikes on my YouTube site for putting up this material. It is easy to communicate. You're going to see everything I'm going to show you. That's why I'm using a PowerPoint. I'm doing it also so I don't go off on tangents, but also it is easy. It is because it's so visual. And we have by far the best and the only antidote and the only answer and the only alternative to what I'm going to introduce today. So bear with me. Let's go ahead and let's really delve into four areas. The first area would be the sources. Then I'm going to go to the problem with Mecca. I'm going to then hit the problem with Muhammad. And I'm going to end with the problem of the Quran. I'm using that, leaving that to the very end, because that's the most damaging. So what do the Muslims claim concerning their standard Islamic narrative? Well, they would claim that for the last 1400 years, Muhammad was the last and the greatest prophet. Born in Mecca in 570, died in Medina in 632. Therefore, he is the model of Islam. He is the paradigm for all the Muslim world, because he is the one that received the final revelation. That revelation is the Quran, sent down between 610 and 632 to Muhammad. It is the greatest and only perfectly preserved and final revelation of all revelations, and it corrects all that had gone before, especially the Old and the New Testament. Therefore, Islam is that final religion based on Muhammad's life and also on the Quran's teaching. That's what they would say. The conclusion? Thus, Islam is completely dependent on three things. The book, the man, and the place. The book being the Quran, the man being Muhammad, and the place being Mecca. Since these three are foundational to Islam, we need to investigate them. At the time they all existed, that's the early 7th century, in the place they existed, that's the Hijaz. That would be the central part of Western Arabia. And that's why, to do that, we need to start with the sources. We need to see where it all came from. Where is everything we know about this man, this book, this place? Where did it all come from? Well, we need to start with those sources. To do that, before we even get started, let's look at a map. Let's look at a map. When you look at the map of that part of the world, now, this is what Muslims tell us. This is not what I'm saying. This is the standard Islamic narrative that we're talking about. What Muslims say, according to their narrative, is that Muhammad's empire included that brown area there. Can you see the brown area there? That's it. Up till 632, that's all that he controlled, or that Islam controlled. And there you can see Mecca and Medina right in the middle. Then after he died in 632, you have Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. And they then expanded the borders to the orange area. So from 632 up until 661, when Muawiyah brought in the Umayyad Caliphate, which would be the first Islamic caliphate there in 661, they had, from 632 to 661, that orange area was the area that they controlled. That's a big area. Are you seeing that? It goes all the way from Tripoli in the west, all the way to Afghanistan in the east, and from Turkey in the north, all the way down to Yemen in the south. Basically, the second biggest empire of its day at that time. And then after 661, after the time of the rightly guided caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, then Muawiyah comes in and he creates the Umayyad dynasty. And the Umayyad dynasty, which continues all the way up until 750, when the Abbasids take over, they then expanded the borders to the purple area. So from Andalusia, which is Spain today, including North Africa, all the way over to Afghanistan, up to Samarkand, and much of what existed before. I'm not interested too much in the purple area today, okay? Don't worry about the purple area. Just what we're going to deal with is the orange and the brown area. That's the material that we want to look at. So let's look at just that area. And to begin that, we need to look at their timeline. So here's the first timeline of many timelines I'm going to give you. Muhammad was born this is their timeline, not mine, okay? Remember, this is their timeline. Muhammad was born in 570. He started receiving the Quran in 610. He then went on a miraj up to the seven heavens from getting back on the winged horse to go up to Jerusalem and going seven heavens up to visit Allah and coming back with five prayers in 621. He then moved from Mecca up to Medina in 622, and then came back and controlled Mecca by 630, and then died in 632. Now, I'm just giving you the bare bones. This is just a skeletal quick look at Muhammad's life. He was then taken over by Abu Bakr, who then only lasted for 2 years, from 632 to 634, there in Medina, they're ruling from that place. He died normally. When he died, Umar takes over, and he expands the borders more so than anybody else between for the next 10 years. He is killed in 644. Uthman takes over, and he continues up until 656 for 12 years, and then he is killed in 656. But in 652, the Quran was compiled. The book that I have in my hand right here, the book that you're all reading, this book, they claim, was compiled by him in 652. You notice that's about 20 years after Muhammad first compiled it, or Abu Bakr first compiled it in 632. So once he is killed in 656, then Ali takes over. He only lasts for 5 years before he is killed at the Battle of Siffin by Muawiyah, and that's the end of the Rashidun period, the golden age of Islam. Note the conclusion. Therefore, Islam was fully formed in the Hijaz by 661 AD. That's what the Muslims are telling us. That's their timeline, not my timeline. However, how do we know all of the above? Where does it come from? Where does everything that I've just told you? Now, I've not told you on everything. I've just given you a bare skeleton. You know an awful lot more than what I've told you. Nonetheless, everything that you know about Islam, how it began, who Muhammad was, what the Quran's all about, where he lived, what he did, what he did with his wives, all those stories about Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali, those great Rashidun period stories, where does it all come from? You'd like to know, right? And you would hope that it came from people who were actually living at that time, who were witness to these events, who heard what this man said, Muhammad said, or saw what he did. You would hope, right? So let's put up another timeline. To understand where that all came from, you need to go back to the standard Islamic narrative again. They will tell you. And what they'll say is Muhammad dies in 632. How do we know that? Because of his biography, the Sirah to Rasulullah, the biography of Muhammad. Who wrote it down? They will say it was written down by this guy here, Ibn Ishaq. Look at his dates, 765. Muhammad dies in 632. Are you starting to see a problem here, folks? That's 130 years later. Did this guy know Muhammad? No, he didn't. Did he live in the same century? Possibly he was born, but was he writing it down? No, he wasn't. But we don't even know anything about Ibn Ishaq. There is not a thing we know about Ibn Ishaq. His book that I have in my hand right here, but it's called The Life of Muhammad, a translation of Ibn Ishaq's Sirah to Rasulullah, written by Alfred Gia. I'm just going to stop sharing so you can all see it. Do you see it right here? This is the book you have to read. This is the book everybody has to read. Anybody that goes and does any course on Islam and Muhammad's life, you have to read this book. The Life of Muhammad, the translation of Ibn Ishaq Sirah to Rasulullah. Notice the name, Ibn Ishaq. There it is, written by Alfred Guillaume. He translated it, okay? So that's the book you all know. That's the book you all have to read. You assume it's by Ibn Ishaq, right? That's what you assume. It's nothing to do with Ibn Ishaq. How do we know that? Because we don't have one word from Ibn Ishaq. What if you read the introduction to that book, you will see it comes from this man here, Ibn Ishaq. And look at his dates. He dies in 833. That's 200 years after Muhammad. And we don't have, and he says clearly that he took what he liked of Ibn Ishaq and threw away the rest and only wrote what he wanted to. So let's just, if that is the case, then obviously he and Al-Waqidi, who comes right after him and writes about the campaigns of Muhammad, they are the only ones that we could go to find out about the biography of Muhammad. If they are the ones that actually write it down, let's get rid of Ibn Ishaq. Goodbye, Ibn Ishaq, because he doesn't have anything to do with us today. But that's not the only genre. We have much more about Muhammad from the hadith. That's the sayings of Muhammad. Now, who wrote the hadith down? Well, the first one to write any down is a guy named Al-Bukhari. Look at his dates, 870. And then we have hadith by Sahih Muslim, 875, At-Tirmidhi, 844, Ibn Majah, 887, Abu Dawud, 899, An-Nisa, 915. Goodness sakes, that's six different hadith that were put together all in the 9th and 10th century. Not one of them was in the same century Muhammad was living. That's 240 years and later, 240 years after Muhammad. And then there are two more genres I want to introduce, and that's the tafsir, which are the commentaries on the Quran, and the tahriq, which would be the histories of all mankind. First, written down by Al-Tabari. Now, there are many that come after him, like Baydawi, Zamakhshari, Suyuti, but it is Al-Tabari that writes the first down. Look at his dates. His is 923. Folks, that's the 10th century. So where do we get the name Muhammad anyways to begin with? It all of the story about him, who he was, and what he said comes from 200 to 300 years too late. I want to bring up this guy right here, Abd al-Malik. Abd al-Malik, in 692, is actually the first one that actually introduces who this person is. And he writes it on the Dome of the Rock, he puts it on coins, and he puts it on protocols in 692. Well, hold on a minute. That's the late 7th century. Did he know Muhammad? No, he didn't. But I want to put him up there because we're going to talk about him later on, because he is the first one that introduces the word or the title or the name Muhammad. Hold on. You're going to see why that's important. But the people that actually introduced the man Muhammad, the one who is the prophet who comes from Mecca and Medina, the man who received the Quran, and the man who started this religion called Islam, are the Abbasids. They are the first ones to introduce this as a religious, in contradistinction to Christianity. So I'm going to put them there, but look at their dates. They don't even come into power to 749. That, folks, is a good 120 years after Muhammad's death, if he even existed. Can you see why we have to bring this up? You need to look at the sources. So, conclusion, Muhammad was revealed 84 years after the Abbasids created him, 141 years after he was first introduced, yet 201 years after he supposedly lived. These are all too late. I hope you're getting what I'm talking about. Let's continue on. It's not just that they're too late. Look and see where the authors were living. Now, what Muslims will tell you is that everything we know about Islam comes from these two cities, Mecca and Medina. That's the Hijaz. That's the central part of Arabia. That is where these men all live. No, they didn't. All of these men were writing in Baghdad. Look where Baghdad is. That's 1,200 miles to the north. Ibn Hisham, who wrote the Sira, was born in Basra, grew up in Cairo, but did all his writing in Baghdad. Cairo is 900 miles away. Basra is 1,200 miles away. So is Baghdad, 1,200 miles away. As far as al-Bukhari, who writes all the sayings about Muhammad, he comes from Bukhara, which is in Uzbekistan. That is 2,600 miles away. Al-Tabari, who wrote the Tafsir and the Tahrik, he is from Tabaristan, what is today northern Iran, and that's 1,700 miles away. None of these traditional writers lived or worked in Mecca or Medina. They were too far to the north of Mecca and came from west and east of Baghdad, and they were writing hundreds of years after the fact. Can you see a problem, folks? Are you starting to get the picture? All of these northern areas are where the Abbasids originated from. These are all Abbasid writers. This is an Abbasid creation. This man, this book, and this place are all Abbasids. So you might say we have the same problem in Christianity. We have also got our Tafsir and the Tahrik and the Sira and yes, the Hadith. Yes, we do. We have the same genre in the New Testament. The Hadith of Jesus would be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That would be the red letter of their writings, the gospel accounts. The Sira of Jesus, the biography of Jesus, would be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, his story for the last 3 years of his life, especially. The Tafsir, which would be the commentaries about what Jesus said, that would be Paul's letters to the different churches and also to Rome. And then, of course, the Tahrik would be the history with the book of Acts. So we've got the same genre, and we must have the same problems. I hear this from Muslims all the time. Let's do a comparison. Now, I'm going to use dates that are going to step on many of your toes. Forgive me. These are very liberal dates that I'm using purposely just to make my point. So the first genre that we have of the Christian traditions would be the Tahrik, would be the book of Acts, written by Luke between 52 and 62 AD. That would be within 20 to 30 years of Christ's death. Then you have the Tafsir, which would be Paul's letters. He was killed in 65 AD. He was starting to write within by 48 AD. So within 15 to 34 years, he's writing the Tafsir of Jesus that he applies what Jesus said into those different cities. And then we get the first Sira and the first Hadith written by Mark in 70 AD. That's 37 years after Christ's death. Matthew and Luke come after that, 80 AD. Folks, don't get angry with me with these dates. I'm giving you the liberal dates, okay? I know some of you are probably festive. These are not the right dates. Yes, these are not the right dates, but these are the most liberal dates. So that's why I'm making a point here. That's within 47 years of Christ's death. And then the last would be the Gospel of John, written around 90 AD, within 57 years of Christ's death. Now, notice all of this Tahrik, Tafsir, Sira, and Hadith of Jesus were written within 60 years of Christ's death. What's more, all of these New Testament writers lived in the same place Jesus lived. And they either knew him personally, that's certainly the case with Matthew and John, or they got the material from others who did know him personally, who saw what he did and heard what he said. That would be Luke and Mark. So can you see, when you do a comparison of these two, everything we know about Christianity comes within 15 to 60 years after Christ's death. Everything we know about Islam comes from 200 to 300 years, hundreds of miles away. Can you see which would be a more authoritative? I would suggest, as a comparison, if we had to depend on sources for Jesus comparable to what Muslims are dependent on for Muhammad, Jesus would not begin to appear until the 3rd century. How would we defend him? Now, remember I just put up that book and I showed you the life of Muhammad, and I said, this is the book you all have to watch, and this is the book you have to read about Muhammad's life? I said that that came from Ibn Ishaq. Well, hold on a minute. We've just found out some new material. Alfred Guillaume did not get it from Ibn Ishaq. He did not get it from Ibn Hisham either. So who actually wrote that book? When was that book compiled? And who was the one that compiled that book? We don't have anything from Ibn Hisham from the 9th century, not a word from the 9th century. I was not aware of this over a year ago. This is all brand new material. So where did that book come from, and where did Alfred Guillaume get his material? He got it from this gentleman, Heinrich Ferdinand Wüstenfels, who between 1858 and 1860 decided to compile this life of Muhammad. And so he went around to four different German cities. He was there in Germany, went to four different universities and different libraries, and started pulling all the Arabic stories he could find. He was an Arabist on this man named Muhammad, put together in a book and published it in 1860, and then translated it. That was translated by Guillaume then into English. Folks, what that means is that the man who Muslims are dependent on to know who their prophet is or what he did is an elderly German linguist who wrote Muhammad's story just 160 years ago, thus over 1,000 years too late. Can you then understand why the scholars are really in consternation? And what they're concluding is, this is what they're saying, not me, this is what they're saying. Islam, as we know it, did not exist in the 7th century, but evolved over a period of 200 to 300 years. The Quran probably was not revealed to one man in 22 years, but likely evolved over a period of 50 to 100 years. Therefore, their conclusion, the history of Islam, at least from the time of the Caliph Abd al-Malik, 685 to 705 and before, is a later fabrication. Can you then understand their concern? Why they say, did it take so long to write it down? Did these people, could they not read and write? Listen, they controlled Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Jerusalem, Cairo by 642. Certainly someone in those cities could read and write. And then from Spain to India, they controlled all that by 685 at the time of Abd al-Malik's reign. Could no one know how to read and write in any of those cities? Of course they could. So where did the 9th and 10th traditional writers get their material from? And should we be trusting it if it's 200 to 300 years later? Should we go back to the 7th century? Should we go back to that time period? Why don't we do that? Let's do that now. And let's now look at Mecca, Muhammad, and the Quran, but only from the 7th century. So let's go right into Mecca, and let's see what we're finding. Now, I'm just going to give you the conclusions now, because I don't want to go, this will take too long, and I don't have that enough time. So if Mecca did not exist, then neither did Muhammad or the Quran. See, Mecca is foundational for both Muhammad and the Quran. If there is no Mecca, can you see the problem? You take away Mecca, then either if you come up with any Muhammad from the 7th century, you have to ask, is he from Mecca? Because there are many Muhammads from the 7th century. That name is a very popular name. And it's not a name. It's a title. It means the praised one, the anointed one. Yes, Jesus was called Muhammad. We're now finding that out. That was his Arabic title from the 6th century on. So if you see the word Muhammad in the 7th century, you need to ask who is writing it and who are they referring to? We're going to get to that. Hold on, because we're going to look at some coins that make that point. So there are many, Qara'a means to write. There are many writings from the 7th century. But is there any book called the Quran that's 114 surahs that is written way down in a place called Mecca? If Mecca doesn't exist, then you can't have a book and you can't have a man. Okay, that's why we're going to start with Mecca, because once you shut down Mecca, you shut down the other two. Mecca is important for Muslims because they believe that it is the earliest and most important city in the history of mankind. Yet references to Mecca in the Quranic and the traditions do not hold up historically. Why? Because it says it's near Sodom and Gomorrah, or that Abraham lived there, or that Ishmael and Hagar lived there. Folks, that's not where they lived, not according to everything that I know. We're going to get to that. Hold on to that thought. Now, the vegetation, when you look at all the vegetation that referred to in the Quran and in the traditions, other references suggest that Mecca is filled with lush fruit trees, grass, grains, streams, which make no sense when you look at Mecca and you look at the soil there. It's been depleted for thousands of years. It is the most desert and most depleted soil on earth. Ironically, though, it's claimed to be the greatest city in history. It is where Adam and Eve were sent to. It is where Abraham lived. It's where 300 of the prophets lived. Yet If it's such a great city, why is the Quran only referred to it once in chapter 48, verse 24, signifying that the authors either did not consider it that important, those who wrote the Quran, or it only came into existence later on. When you look at the geographical claims in the Quran, we'll find that all the references to these geographical claims are up in the north around the people of Adur, the people of Thamud, the people of Midian. Look on the map on the right and see where they all are. They're up in what is today Jordan, 600 miles to 1,000 miles too far north. Mecca is right there at the bottom. That it's in the wrong place. All these geographical claims in the Quran are way too far to the north. More than that, when you look at the Arabic in the Quran, the Arabic in the Quran, folks, is Nabataean Aramaic. It has the Aleph Maksura. It has the Tar Marbuta. It has the definite article. That is not the Arabic that would have been spoken way down in what is today Mecca and Medina. They use Sabaic Arabic, which does not have the Tar Marbuta or the Aleph Maksura or the definite article. It's the wrong Arabic. And what's interesting, the Arabic in the Quran is 600 miles further north. Are you starting to get a theme that's going on over and over here? Mecca is where Muslims claim that 70 to 300 prophets are buried. Yet with all the buildings that are now being constructed around Mecca requiring deep foundations, they have yet to find even one. It seems that what the Arabs are doing and the Muslims are doing there in Arabia, they're covering it up, cementing it up, because they don't want people to investigate, because they can't find a thing that's earlier than an old Ottoman fort from 1300 AD. Well, that's why we need to ask the question. And Dr. Patricia Corona, who reads and writes 15 languages, she asked this question. Did anybody, any civilization surrounding it? She went to the Nabataeans. She went to the Romans, the Assyrians. She went to the Persians. She went to the Himyarites. She went to the Nubians. She went to every civilization you can see on that map there on the right. She asked the question, was there any people in these civilizations that all predated the 7th century? Did any of them know about the city Mecca? She could not find one reference at all, not one reference to the city with all these surrounding civilizations. When you look at a map of Arabia, look at all these other insignificant cities like Marib or Najran or Sana or Taif or Yathrib or Khaybar or Petra or Mamre. Look at all these cities that are there on the Western Plateau, and you'll notice they are all have geographical and they all have historical antecedents. They are referred to over and over and over again by many journalists, by many historians. Not one word about Mecca. Why are these insignificant cities all referred to? And many of them are just hamlets, and yet Mecca is not. When you do look at that, you'll see why. Just look at a topographical map, and you will notice that all of these cities are along the Western Plateau. That's the trade route. Mecca is off the Western Plateau by 3,000 feet. It's way down. It has no water. If you don't have any water, well, we're going to get to that. Hold on to that thought. But can you see why? No wonder no one's ever heard of Mecca, because it's nowhere where everybody lived. No one would go there because it's off the trade route. It's not even on the Western Plateau. Now, the first reference we have to Mecca anywhere, and this is what Dr. Patricia Corona did. She went and studied this when she was at Oxford University, head of department there, wrote two books, Hagarism and Meccan Trade and the Rise of Islam, where because of those two books, she got death threats and had to move to Cambridge University. But what she noticed is the first reference we can find to Mecca, the city itself, is not till 741 AD. Folks, that's the 8th century. That's over 100 years after Muhammad died. If that's the first reference, and that reference puts Mecca way up in southern Turkey, it's even in the wrong place. She went back to all the maps. I don't have time to get into them. We'll be doing this at ELF. But if you look at all the maps, look at Ptolemy, who is the only one that wrote about the geography of Arabia. Mecca is missing in his geography. It's missing on all the maps, even as late as the 15 and the 1600s. So neither the land trade route nor the sea, Red Sea trade route, we shut that one down about 3 years ago. Look at all the Red Sea trade routes. They all went on the western side, on the African side, on the western coast. Why? Because there's water there. And where there's water, there is food. And when there is food, there are people. The people, there are towns. Towns are cities. Cities are civilizations. Civilizations, there's a history. You cannot have a history if there's no people there. There's nothing on the eastern side because there's just desert there. Now, a possible reason The why, and I've just given it to you, is because take a look at any map of Mecca and Medina, and you will see they're in the middle of a desert. And in the middle of the desert, you cannot have a whole history. You cannot even have a whole theological precept. When you look at the Quran, look at all the theological debate. You have to have people to debate with. You have to have theological discussion to create that. Take a look at them. They're attacking the Jews. They're attacking the Christians. They're attacking the pagans, especially the Jews and Christians. There were no Jews and Christians that far south. None of them came down there for a very good reason. There's no water. No water, no food, no food, no people, no people, no towns, no towns, no city, no cities, no civilization, no civilization, no history. Despite Muslims' claim for the Zamzam well, which they all claim, oh, there was water, Mr. Smith, and it's inexhaustible water. That's why 4 million people can drink it today. No. Who creates that water? That comes from 27 desalination plants created by Bechtel Corporation, United States. Thank God for America. This has nothing to do with Arabia and has nothing to do with the Saudi Arabian government. There is Queen Zubaydah's aqueduct in 801. It was such a problem that she had to put an aqueduct in 9th century AD. So you can see all of this material we can shut down. Now, Muslims have no idea why all the earliest Qiblas. Look at all the mosques. They all have Qiblas, direction of prayer, facing where? They're all facing Petra up until 706. They don't begin to face Mecca until 715. For that reason, this suggests that Mecca was chosen in the 8th century as their final sanctuary. The antecedents for Meccan pilgrimage makes more sense with Jerusalem than they do to Petra. Look at all that they do in Mecca. Most everything they do in Mecca came earlier from Jerusalem. They're just copying what was already in Jerusalem. Now, conclusion, certainly someone somewhere at some time should have known about this city, yet no one anywhere, not at any time before the 7th century, proving that it never existed at the time of Muhammad, nor during early Islam. So if Mecca did not exist, then what do we do with Muhammad and the Quran? Where did they come from? Let's go and let's unpack that. So now we go right from Mecca, we go then to Muhammad. To understand Muhammad, you have to follow the evidence. Now, what are the claims they make? Well, Muhammad, they say, was the last and greatest prophet who was born in Mecca in 570 and died in Medina in 632. He is the model for Islam. He is the one that received the final revelation. Therefore, everything we need to know about him, we should be able to find from the Sira ibn Hisham and the Hadith of al-Bukhari. I pretty much shut those two down because look at the dates. How can we find out a man who died in 632 from people who are writing about him in 833 and 870? You can't trust people who are writing 200 to 300 years later and hundreds of miles away. These references are just too far away and too late. So let's go back to the 7th century. But there's nothing there. There's absolutely not. Oh, hold on a minute. There are. There are things there. And here's what's beautiful. There are coins and there are rock inscriptions. That's the beauty. See, coins don't disintegrate. They don't deteriorate. They're as pristine today as the day they were minted. Because they're made out of copper, they're made out of silver, and they're made out of gold. Inscriptions on rocks, well, they just chisel them on the rocks. Rocks do not disintegrate. So let's look at the coins. The reason they're so important, because they were around since 600 BC. The Lydians were the ones that created them. They were used for commerce, but not just for commerce. They were also used by new rulers. Whenever they came to power, the first thing they did, since they didn't have TV or internet or newspaper or radio, they used coins to introduce themselves. These coins were then, what the first thing they would do is they would then put their image on the coin. They would put their name on the coin. They would say who they are because they knew that the coins would be used by everybody. And since they were in the hands of everybody, everybody then knew who the ruler was. And one of the first things they would do after they put their image and their name, they would put their religion. They would put a symbol to show what religion they belonged to. If they were Christians, they would put a cross and then the date and then the mint where they were made. So therefore, we can look at them. But here's the problem. The numismatists, the experts, are having a problem. And they're contacting me, and they've been doing so since 2020, because they're saying, we have the coins, we own the coins. The problem is they don't make any sense, because when you're looking at the coins and you take the Islamic tradition, the standard Islamic narrative, you can't put it, it doesn't make sense on what the coins are said. So this is what I'm telling them, all right? Then if you don't make sense, dispense with the tradition and go back to the 7th century when these are minted and then tell me what they say. Just use what they say. That is the job of any historian. That is the job of any numismatist. Just read the coins and then make and find out and tell me what happened. So let's look at the map again. Now, what Muslims tell us is that everything that happened where all the coins were minted and everything that went on, because it was the caliphs that mint the coin, had to be where the caliphs lived. And Muhammad, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman, and Ali all lived in Medina. Can you see Medina there? And they all, of course, then moved out to Mecca. I mean, that's where Muhammad moved to, and that's where he was first. So Mecca and Medina would be the place where these mints would be, where these coins were, because that's where they were ruling. If that was the case, we should find mints there. We cannot. So where are all the mints? Take a look where they all are. In Tartus, and Hims, and Baalbek, and Damask, Damaria, Abilia. Oh, I'm just destroying the words. So you can read them there on the screen. They're way up in what is today Jordan and Syria and in Lebanon and Israel. On the eastern side, these would all be in what is today Iraq and Iran. There, none of them are down in the south. Why are there no mints down in Mecca and Medina? Well, one very, very good reason. There's no water down there. You're not going to have coins unless you have people. And in order to have people, you have to have food. In order to have food, you need water. If there's no water or any industry or no trade going on down there, why would you have coins? You need to have trade. You need to have people who are involved in trade. So all of these mints would have been under the authority of any Arab leader in the 7th century and any caliph in the 7th century, including all of the Muslim caliphs. Yet none of these mints were in the Hijaz. Instead, they were all situated too far to the north, possibly because the Hijaz was a desert with no water. You know the rest of the story. So let's look at a timeline and let's look and see where these coins are. Now, Muhammad dies in 632. There are no coins whatsoever with his name on it. There are coins, yes, but none with his name on it. They are in Arabic, yes, but nothing about him. And that includes also those who come after him, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. Up until 661, we can't find any reference to any of these caliphs on any coins. Just doesn't exist. Then the Sassanid Empire, we look at the Arab coins. They're Christian coins. How do we know that? Just take a look at them. Take a notice. Do you see? There is the caliph. He's not Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, Ali. He is from that time period, but he's up in the north. And notice what he has above his head and what he has on his stave, but also what's above the M, which is the number 40. Those are crosses, proving that these were all Christians. Well, if that's the case, what about Muawiyah? He must be the first of the Islamic caliphs because he is the one that introduces the Umayyad caliphate. He lives up in Damascus. So he is the one that rules from 661 up until 680. And here's what's interesting. Take a look at his coins. There's a picture of Muawiyah there. Notice what's above his head, a cross. Notice what he's holding, a cross. He has two crosses on either hand, and there's a cross above the M on the back side of the coin. By the way, these coins are front and back, front and back, front and back. That's why there's two of every one. Now, especially look at the coin on the right. Oh, dear. There's Muawiyah. He has a cross above his head. He's holding a cross. On the back side, there's the letter M, which is 40. There's a cross above it, but look what's written underneath it. Muhammad, M-H-M-D. That's Muhammad. Muhammad? The man? Look and see on the front side and also on the back there. How could Muhammad be a Christian? So obviously, this is not a name. This is a title, the Anointed One. Who do you think the Anointed One is? Take a look at this inscription here. Here's an inscription by Muawiyah. You can see his name right there. I've just underlined it in red. There's his name written in Greek. Isn't that interesting? He's using Greek, and it's there at the Dam of Taif, and he puts it there, and he says, Muawiyah Abdullah, the slave of God. Now, remember, he's using Arabic here. Allah is a name for God in Arabic for the Christians, for the Jews, for the Zoroastrian, for the atheists. Everybody used the name Abdullah, just like we do in English, G-O-D in English. So it is the generic title for any God. So he is the slave of God or the servant of God. And then it says the commander of the believers. Commander of which believers? Look on the upper left. And what do you see right there? A cross. He is a Christian. So it's obviously that Muawiyah, who not only has crosses on his coins, he also has it on his inscription, proving he was a Christian. I'm not saying this. The rocks say it. And if I don't say it, the rocks are going to cry out for me. Let the rocks speak. So, folks, that's why we use coins. Now, let's don't stop with the coins. Then we get to the late 7th century, and we get to the time of Abdul Malik. Abdul Malik comes to power in 685. He is a Christian, but he's an anti-Trinitarian Christian. He does not believe in the Trinity. He does not believe in the divinity of Jesus. He confronts the Byzantine Christians. There's a picture of the coins with the Heraclius and his two signs on either side. That's a Byzantine Christian solidus gold coin. He introduces this coin in 692 to mock Heraclius. And notice what he does. He takes off the cross and he disfigures the cross on the backside. This is an attack against Justinian II, the Byzantine Caliph at that time, in 692. Justinian goes to war with him. He loses the war. Abd al-Malik wins the war, and he introduces this coin. Notice what he's done. He now puts his image on the coin with a sword saying, I am the victor. And around the outside, it's La ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. For there is only one God but God. And the anointed one, or the blessed one, is the servant of God. Who is the blessed one here? Well, obviously, look on the backside. You can see it's all attacking Jesus. It's all attacking his Trinity. It's attacking his divinity. It's attacking his sonship. So this is about Jesus, the Muhammad. The Jesus, the praised one, is the servant of God. He then takes this coin. This is my coin. I've got it. I own it now. Cost me a good penny. A lot of pennies, actually. And you can see he's taken his image. This is 696. He introduces this coin. There's the Shahada on the front. There is on the back is from chapter 4, verse 171 of the Quran today. Say not three, for God is one and he has no son. That's attacking the Trinity, attacking Jesus' divinity, attacking his sonship. It's all an attack against Jesus. And he is the praised one. The praised one is nothing more than the servant of God. Folks, this is an anti-Trinitarian attack against Byzantine Trinitarian Christianity. So that's the coins do that. Now, what about the rock inscriptions? The same story on the rock inscriptions. The beautiful thing about rocks, they don't disintegrate either. Notice where the rock inscriptions are in the 7th century. They're way up in the north. They're way down in the south. Why aren't the rock inscriptions in the middle where they should be? If these are all Arabic rock inscriptions and their prayers to Allah, why aren't they where Muhammad and Abu Bakr, Uthman and Ali, all the rightly guided caliphs live? The reason is very simple. That central part is all desert. So when we look at the rock inscription, you need to go to Ilka Lindstedt's material. He looked from 640 up to 740, that 100-year period. And notice that he said that prior to 690, except for formula, everything comes after 690, the late 7th century. Muhammad died in 632. So we're 60 years later, and there's nothing Islamic about any of these inscriptions. And then into the 8th century, suddenly this prophet, who was introduced by Abd al-Malik on his coins in 692, he then starts to appear in around 710. Around 710 to 720, these Muslim rites start to appear, but not the word Muslim, the pilgrimage, the prayer, and the fast. It's not till 730 that the name Muslim is introduced and the name Islam is introduced, referring to a specific people in contradistinction to Christianity. Folks, that is over 100 years too late. The rock inscriptions are damaging hugely the Islamic narrative. It was only in the 730s onwards that there is evidence of a popular devotion to a man named Muhammad as a prophet and a messenger, which makes the Islamic traditions incredibly awkward. Furthermore, there is a 100-year silence prior to this that indicates that Islam did not exist as a distinct religion until long after the time of Muhammad, which casts doubt on whether he had any part in starting it. But the name Muhammad does occur in Christian writings in the 7th century. So let's look at them. Let's look at them real quickly. Now, when you look at in the name, remember that in Arabic, the name is not the name. It's a title, the praised one, the blessed one, the anointed one. On Fander Films right now, I'm putting up video after video with Mel, my right-hand man. We're putting up and we're following the whole antecedents to the name Muhammad. Look at the videos on Fander Films. We're shutting down this notion that this was a man named Muhammad from Arabia. This name goes all the way back to 1400 BC. It is not a name. It is a title. It's right there in Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verse 16. Muhammad. Muhammad, Solomon himself refers to himself as Muhammad, the blessed one, the anointed one. So thus it is not a name. So almost anyone can use this title in Arabic, including even when referring to Jesus Christ. To understand this point, let's look at the Quran and let's notice the Dome of the Rock. Let's end with those two. When you look at the Quran, there are only four references. Here is a man who is supposed to, the entire book supposed to be about, yet he's only referred to four times. Jesus is referred to 93 times. Who do you think is more important? In chapter 3, verse 144, in chapter 33, in chapter 47, in chapter 48, none of them refer to a person called Muhammad who lived in the Hijaz in Arabia. They are most likely referring to the Blessed One, as we have noted that this is a word Muhammad, which that's what it means, who could very well be Jesus Christ. If this is not the prophet from Mecca at all, then Muslims cannot use the Quran to support Muhammad's, the prophet's existence in the 7th century, and one of the foundation of pillars go completely flat. When you look at the Dome of the Rock built by Abd al-Malik in 691, notice, look at the inner ambulatory where the two green arrows are. Those are the only original part of the building. And look at the inscriptions that are written. They're still there today. They are all, again, say not one, but say not three, for God is one and he has no son. That's attacking the Trinity, the divinity of Jesus. For God does not begetteth, nor is he begotten. That's attacking his sonship. And then you have the Shahada, la ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah. There's only one God but God. And the praised one that these inscriptions are all about are nothing more than the messenger of God. If correct, then Muslims cannot use the Dome of the Rock to support Muhammad's existence in the 7th century either, even as late as 691. And another foundational pillar of Islam begins to fall. So, what about the written references to Muhammad in the 7th century? Can there a lot? Thomas the Presbyter in 634 refers to the Taye of Muhammad. Notice the spelling. It is a Persian spelling. And this, he is a Lakhmid. Look where the Lakhmids are. They're in northern Iraq. This Muhammad comes from northern Iraq. He more than likely, that's referring to Jesus. There's a flyleaf in 636 that's called the Arabs of Muhammad, who killed many Syrians in Yarmouk. Yarmouk, that's way up in Jordan, in Syria, folks. Muhammad never went that far north, and he never fought against the Syrians. We don't know of anything that's way too far north. And then in 660, Sabaeus talks about the Ishmaelite called Muhammad with 12,000 Israelites. There's no record of any 12,000 Arabs partnering with any Jews invading Byzantium in the 7th century. This is not even historical. They've got the wrong person at the wrong place and certainly at the wrong time. John and Bar Ben Kaab probably comes the closest. Muhammad, the teacher and leader of the Arabs. This is the first real good reference, but still way too far north, and no suggestion of Islam or of him being a Muslim. And it's John of Damascus that we need to look at. 730, he is the first one to actually reference Muhammad, and looks like this is the Muhammad we're looking for. But notice what he says, that he has these ludicrous doctrines and that he comes with four books: the cow, which is Surah 2, women, which is Surah 4, table, which is Surah 5, and camel, which is Surah 0. Nothing. There is no camel in the Quran. And there are not just four books in the Quran. There's 114. So evidently, whatever the Quran is that he's talking about, it's not the Quran that we have today. And look at the date. This is 730. He's not even referring to Muslims. He calls them Ishmaelites. Conclusion, every reference to Muhammad in the 7th century places him in Gaza or Jerusalem or Damascus or in Hira, which are situated way too far north and probably refer to another Muhammad called the Praised One, not the Muhammad of Islam. So, conclusions. There are no coins anywhere in Central Arabia, and the Arab coins which do exist are all further north and are not Islamic at all, but Christian or Zoroastrian, up to and including the reign of Muawiyah. It is only with the coins introduced by Abd al-Malik that we begin to possibly find a pre-Islamic coin, yet they could be referencing Jesus or any other caliph. Even the rock inscriptions, they say nothing Islamic prior to 690, then references to Muhammad from 690 to 710, Muslim rites and prayers and pilgrimages and fasts from 710 to 720, and finally, the name Muslim and the name Islam, referencing a group which is not Christian from 720 to 730. The Quran and the Dome of the Rock do not refer to Muhammad of Islam. The 7th century references to Muhammad place him too far north. Therefore, our conclusion, these are all suggest that there was an internecine clash between different sects within Christianity, the Trinitarians versus the anti-Trinitarians, with the later establishing its own religion at the time of the Umayyad dynasty in opposition to Christianity, mid-8th century, which then morphed into Islam of today during the initial 100 to 200 years of the Abbasid dynasty in the 9th and 10th century. That's why everything we know about Islam, about this man, about this book, about their theology, all comes from the 9th and 10th century, 2 to 300 years too old. So what about the Quran? What we do know about the Quran is this. They claim that it's uncreated. They claim it was sent down. They claim it was completed by Uthman, and they claim it was unchanged. If you just remember those four words, uncreated, it has never been created, it is eternal, sent down to Muhammad between 610 and 632, completed by Uthman in 652, and since the time of 652, there has not been one letter, not one word that has been changed. Now, if that is their claim, do we make these claims? Please don't. Well, the reason we don't is because there's no way that we could make those claims. But the Muslims have to make these claims because it's in the Quran itself. Uncreatedness is in chapter 85, verse 21 and 22. The fact that it's never changed is in chapter 10, verse 15, and also 18, verse 27. And the reason why is because Muhammad protects it and guards it is in chapter 15, verse 9. So don't get upset for them for claiming that they have to. We would never claim that about the Bible. Please don't. The Bible was created by men. We know that. It was not sent down to anyone. It was inspired by God. The Bible was complete in its original form. Has the Bible been changed? That's a huge debate within Christianity. I'm not going to get into that debate. What we do know is this. Our remit today is we cannot confront the created or sent down. What we must confront are the complete and the end change, those second two. Therefore, I'm going to demand of any Muslim, if they are going to make these claims, they got to show me one manuscript of the Quran from the mid-7th century, which is complete. That means all 114 surahs and unchanged, exactly like the Quran I have in my hand today. Now, where do we find out about the creation of the Quran? We need to go to our good old friend, Al-Bukhari. Notice he's the one that tells us how the Quran was created. But he tells us that in 870. The Quran was supposedly compiled and finished in 630 and then compiled in its final form in 652. If that is the case, you've got it almost 240 years too late. Now, what Al-Bukhari says is this, that when Muhammad died in 632, Uthman had to rewrite the Quran in 652, and he sent five copies of that rewritten to five different cities, Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Mecca, and Medina. Here's the problem. He sent that in 652. Where is there even one of them? What we do know is that after, in the later 7th century, according to the tradition, not me, according to tradition, another Quran suddenly appears in Damascus with 116 surahs. That's two more than the Quran we have today, written by Ubay ibn Ka'b. Another appears in Baghdad, written by Ibn Mas'ud. It only has 110 surahs. That's four less than the Quran we have today. And then another appears by Ibn Musa in Basra, and it has 114 surahs. And it's Zayd ibn Thabit is the one that is the original one. Can you see? They don't equate. But therefore, it was at least five different Qurans in the 7th century from Mecca, Medina, Basra, Kufa, and Damascus. Why is it we don't have one of them today? That's only 1,400 years ago. But then something happens between the 7th and 8th century. The Qira'at Qurans begin to appear. Well, what are we talking about the Qira'ats? Well, a historical review. The Arabic in the 7th century only had about 16 letters. That's the problem. 16 consonants. There were no vowels at that time. The Arabic today has 28 now consonants. How do we know? Because dots were then added in the 8th and 9th century in order to read them. Therefore, once the dots were beginning to appear, then you need to have vowels to know how to pronounce them. So three vowels then were introduced called harakas, and they were introduced in the late 8th, early 9th century. So let me just show you what I'm talking about. Here are the original or the oldest manuscripts we have, the Samarkand on the left, the Sana on the right. Notice there are no dots, no vowels on them. How would you read them? Any Arab speakers, can you read them? No, you can't. So what you need to do is you need to create vowels. Now, this is the modern standard Arabic today. Notice there's 28 letters, but six of them don't need any dots. The alif doesn't need a dot, the kaf doesn't need a dot, nor the lam, nor the mim, nor the ha, nor the waw. Those six don't need dots. All the other 22 need dots. So if you put one dot above it, it becomes a na, a nen. Two dots above it becomes a ta or a t. Three dots above it becomes a tha or a th. One dot below it becomes a b or a ba. And two dots below it becomes a ya or a y. Now you have five dots, you can make five different letters. It suddenly starts to appear, but you need pronunciation. If you have one curly Q above it, it becomes an U or a Dhamma. One below it becomes a E or a Kasa. One above it becomes a or a Fata. So folks, can you see, if you put those three dots together and with vowels, and you could put them just on three letters next to each other, you can get 19 different words just by changing the dots. Here, can you see why dots and vowels are so important? But there were no dots and vowels in the 7th century. If the Quran had been created in the 7th century, then what is it? What Quran are we using today? Well, obviously, once the dots and vowels were starting to be introduced, then you had many people starting to put their dots where they wanted to and their vowels where they wanted to. And they started creating Qurans all over the place. Quran spun, Quran spun, Quran, Quran. So many that, according to Dr. Shadi Nasser, by the 10th century, there were 700 different Qurans, 700 different writings. So there was a problem. And that's why in the 10th century, in 936, a guy named Ibn Mujahid was asked to choose seven. And these are the seven he chose. Nafi from Medina, Ibn Kathir from Mecca, Abu Amr from Basra, Ibn Amir from Damascus, Asim from Kufa, Hamza from Kufa, and Al-Kisai from Kufa. Ah, these are the seven that are the ones that were there when Muhammad was reciting it and receiving it from Jibril in the 7th century, right? No, no, no. Look at the dates they died. 785, 738, 770, 736, 740. Folks, this is the 8th, 805, and the 9th century. This is the 8th, the 9th century. None of these guys knew Muhammad. They were not even living in the same century as Muhammad. So when Ibn Mujahid chose him in the 10th century, either he didn't know this or he didn't bother to look at their death dates. None of these guys knew Muhammad. But still, that wasn't good enough because there were so many Qurans. And the Quran I have in my hand today, this one here, is the Hafs an-Asim. Where is that in that list? This book, This one here that everybody uses, 93% of the Muslim world uses today, the Hafs and Asim, is not in that list. So in the 12th century, in 1194, Shatibi had to choose two students from every one of those seven, and those are the 14 he chose in 1194, or just before he died in 1194. So now we have seven, and now we have 14. We now have 21 different Qurans. That still wasn't good enough. In the 15th century, in 1429, a guy named Al-Jazari chose another three Qiraats and another six students to go with him, another nine different Qurans. Now you have seven plus 14 plus three plus six. You now have 30 different Qurans by the 15th century. Hold on a minute. Maybe they all say the same thing. No, they do not. We have all 30 of them now, thanks to Hatuntash, who is my colleague. She's missing, folks. We don't know where she is. You need to pray for her. But we do know she's safe. At least we know she's safe. She is the one that's found all 30 of these, going to Jordan, going to Syria, going to Yemen, and going to I can't think of the place where she went to in Northern Africa, Morocco. And so she found all 30 of them. And we decided to find out how many of them are different from this one right here that I circled in black, because that's the official one that's used today. It was made official in 1924. I'm going to talk about that. Hold on a minute. So if you look at the other 29, how many differences do you have between them and this one right here? Folks, 93,000 differences, 93,000 different words, 93,000 different meanings, which means different theologies, yes, and different doctrines, and even different practices. We took these just 26 of them down to Speaker's Corner in 2016, caused a huge furore. It was the first time anybody had seen them. We held them up, and there was a man there named Ahmed Hijab. You can see him on the right there. He goes outside the crowd, and he calls all the Muslims to come to him. Come to me. Don't watch what they're doing, and don't listen to what they're saying. I'll explain it. That was in 2016. What was he trying to do? He needed to explain every one of these. Here are the 26 that she has found. These are the ones we held up there at Speaker's Corner in 2016. These are all Hatuns, Qiraats, and Ahrufs. Now notice, no two are alike. And just between these 26, there's about 80,000 differences. So we want to say, how different are they? I'm not going to go through every one of these guys because I'm running out of time. If you look at the left, you see it's Qatala. On the right, it's Qutila. One means fought, one means killed. Folks, if I'm a prophet, I'd rather fight than be killed. So that has a real problem for prophets. Here in chapter 43, verse 19, it says those are the angels who are slaves of the beneficent are females. And the right, the Rao, the text says, in the presence. Are the angels slaves of Allah, or are they simply in the presence of Allah? Is it the slaves or those in Allah's presence who will be made females? I would prefer being in God's presence rather than being a slave. And folks, since I'm a male, I'd rather prefer being a male rather than being made females. Here you have Isanan on the right, doing good. And here you have Husnan, beauty, on the right, on Al-Duri. This is about the child of the sons of a couple. Are men supposed to do good or be beautiful to their parents? I have three sons. I would rather they do good, folks, not be good looking. And then probably one of the more damaging ones. I'm just giving you four examples of 93,000. Bariati in chapter 98, verse 6, it says creatures on one side. It says the innocent on the other in Warsh. Now, folks, these are us in heaven. Are we in hell? Are we those the worst of creatures, or are we the worst of the innocent? As Christians, I would rather be innocent rather than the worst of creatures. And if I'm innocent, then what in the world am I doing in hell? So you can see that's theological problems, doctrinal problems, and also in the practice. This became such a problem that back in 2020, in June 8, Yasser Qadhi was asked to have an interview by Mohammed Hijab. And he went for about 28 minutes, asking this question. Put out his hand, and he said, which Quran, which is the one you're going to put in my hand? Is it Qisai? Is it Hafs? Is it what? Before he could finish, Yasser Qadhi said, we do not talk about this. We do not bring this up in public. Do not ask me this question. Turn off the camera. He said, this has been the most difficult problem for Muslim scholars for the last 1,000 years. We have a respect for the Quran. And there is a red line. We don't go beyond that red line. But when I was at Yale University getting my doctorate on this in 1995, there were no red lines at Yale University. And I had a crisis of knowledge, he said. The standard Islamic narrative, he's pointing to Muhammad Hijab, your narrative, your standard Islamic narrative has holes in, he said. And we cannot answer this questions because the Western academics have come leaps and bounds on this issue in the last 100 years. And they look at us like the emperor with no clothes. He said, I never lectured on this subject, nor will I ever. You will never find me excellent unless you take my class. This subject should never be brought up in public. Don't ask me to say what should be written on the blank mushaf. Finally, after 28 minutes, he had to come up with a solution. So he said, fine, okay. They are all the Quran, all 30 of the Quran. A little bit of Hafs, a little bit of Wars, a little bit of Kain. You can put them all together and just mix them up. What he didn't know, and I started clapping, what he didn't know is that there were 93,000 differences. He had no idea. So what about the earliest Quranic manuscripts? Are they corrupted? Folks, there are only 6 manuscripts that they can point to that are their earliest manuscripts. The top copy on the left, the Samarkand on the right, the top copy is from the mid-8th century. It has 2,270 manuscript variants. It is the best they have got because it's about 99% of the Quran itself, but it's from the mid-8th century. And we're not even sure if that date is correct. And folks, can you see this is over 100 years after Muhammad? It does not have the dots and vowels you're looking for. The one on the right, you might as well throw away. It only goes up to Surah 43. There are 114 surahs in the Quran. It has hundreds of manuscript variants. Of the 43 chapters that are there, only one of them is complete. 16 are missing. And that which is there is so full of grammatical errors. It was obviously written by somebody who didn't know Arabic. The Ma'il one, which is in London in England, that one we have gone to, it also goes only up to Surah 43. Surah 43, it is written in the Ma'il manuscript text. It is much cruder, it is dated to the late 8th century, around 790. The Petropolitanus on the right, that is there in Paris, François Deroche is the one that really controls it, and it only encompasses about 25% of the Quran. And it has 93 manuscript variants in it. The one on the left there, the Husseini, it is full of coverings. It is a huge monumental text from the 9th century, not from the 7th or the 8th century. It has hundreds of coverings. We're going to talk about that a little bit. In the Sana manuscript on the right, the most exciting, it has a palimpsest that has an underlayer of 60 verses with 73 manuscript variants from the upper text. And it also it is probably the oldest of all of them. But on the right-hand side of the page, you can see pictured there, that is dated to 705. The left-hand side of the page is dated to about 60 to 70 years later. Summary, none of them are from the 7th century. None of them are complete. None of them completely agree with each other. None of them completely agree with the current 1924 Hafs text. All of them have hundreds, even thousands of subsequent manuscript variants. So when was their Quran complete? When you look at the Sana, when you look at the undertext, 63 verses, 70 variants, with all kinds of mistakes, proving that this is a text in evolution. The Birmingham Folio that Muslims claim is the oldest Quran, that it dates around the same time as Muhammad, 568 to 645. I have no problem with those dates, but it's only 2 pages front and back. It's only 33 verses from 3 different surahs, chapter 18, chapter 19, and chapter 20. The one on chapter 18 is the 7 sleepers of Ephesus. That has nothing to do with Islam. It was written in 512 AD. So it's before the Quran. It's before Islam. The Surah 19:90-91 is the proto-evangelium of James. That's from the 2nd century AD. It's long before the Quran. It has nothing to do with Islam. And then chapter 20, verse 1 to 40 is the story of Moses, which comes straight out of our Bible, which is from 1400 BC. So you can see all of these stories are stories that were there before the Quran. Of course, they were written in Arabic with no dots and vowels because there were Arab Christians who were writing them, and Jews who were writing them, and sectarians who were writing them. So obviously they would have been around in Arabic. That doesn't mean the fact that they're not even together even where the Quran is proves that these are the borrowing that were then made into the Quran. Now, Dr. Dan Brubaker's book, and you need to get this book, he is probably the one that's done the most damage because he has gone back to these manuscripts. He has gone back to the Quranic text, and he's looked at them and photographed them, and he's found insertions, deletions, corruptions all the way through. Look at here. Here are some examples of assertions that were done at a later date. Here's examples of erasers. Why would you erase something unless you want to censor it? What's interesting, what is left behind now supports the Hafs text that we use today. Here you have erasers overwritten. And you can see the erase. You can see there's a word underneath it. Why have they overwritten it? It now supports the Hafs text. Here you have overwriting without even, they didn't even bother. They were in a hurry. whole sentences that have been written over top, which now support the Huff's text. Selective coverings. I talked about the Husseini manuscript. You look at the one in the middle. There are eight different coverings on one page. It just looks like chicken scratches what's left behind. And what is there that's left behind now supports the current Huff's text. Selective coverings overwritten. The same thing. All of this was done to censor it, to tape it, and to cover it so it would be centered, so it would come support the Huff's text. Now, they wanted to take us down in 2019. I was there in London. I got up on the ladder where there's Hutton Tosh on the left of me, and we want to introduce this book. Mansoor Ahmad, the guy on the right there in the blue shirt, he is the leading authority in Britain. He is there on the Islamic Awareness site, and he wanted to shut us down. And so he put his ladder next to me, and we had a debate. It's a great debate. You can go see it online. And he started claiming there on the ladder that they can trace the Quran all the way back to Muhammad. Then he quickly changed to Uthman. So I confronted him three different times. I said, okay, where is this complete manuscript, 114 surahs from the time of Muhammad, from the 7th century? He could not find it from the time of Uthman. He would not talk about the time of the 7th century. I said, well, then what about, he kept on saying the first Islamic century, which goes up to 790. I said, okay, where is this complete Quran that's 114 surahs from 719? He finally says we have 96 or 97%. What did he mean by that 97%? Well, I went up the next day to look on the Islamic Awareness website, and here's what he's talking about. That's what they're talking about. He's talking about 63 manuscripts or fragments. Some of them are only one verse long that they put together, amalgamated together, so they could get 79% of the Quran by 719, by the early 8th century. We decided to shut him down. So I and our team went to look at every one of those, and this is what we have found. 20 of them, the ones you see going up in the green arrows there, see them going up on the screen? They are tentatively dated. That means nobody has come to any conclusion because they're just tentatively dated. So you cannot use those 20. 9 of them, the ones that are in blue, including the largest one, which is half the Quran, that's the Ma'ilq manuscript, the 2165 manuscript. They are all dated after 719. That one is dated to 790, the late 8th century. So you can't use those manuscripts. They should be thrown out. There goes half the Quran right there, just that one. And the other 34, the ones I'm putting up in red right up there, those arrows, no one has done any work on. So how do they even know? They just put them there. They put because they needed this verse, they needed that verse, they needed this surah, they needed that surah. So they amalgamated them together to get 97% of the Quran without realizing that we would check up on them. So what that conclusion is, none of them are really valid. The conclusion, all of them are either later or tentatively dated or have no supporting evidence. So they should not have been used. So therefore, folks, where did we get this Quran that we all have in our hands today? We got it in 1924. Remember I said there were 30 different Qurans? In Cairo, in Egypt, in 1924, they were having a problem with standardized tests. The high school students were coming in there giving 30 different answers. So somebody had to do something. So they went to Al-Azhar University and they asked Muhammad Ali al-Husseini al-Haddad to please choose just one. And he chose this one. Why? Because this is the one that the Ottomans chose. They liked it the best. That's why they were the ones that used it since the 1300s, since the 14th century. And that's why all those manuscripts have the changes, because they controlled those manuscripts for 700 years. So he said, with all these manuscripts, we've got to have that one, because that was the one that became the focal. That was the standard for all the other. Therefore, he had to choose the Huff's text. That became so successful. Why? Because they took the other 29 Qurans out into a boat and they threw them into the Nile River, thinking that would be the end of the story. Little did they know that many people had the other Qurans. Became such a problem all over Egypt that in 1936, they had to make Huff's the standard text for the entire country. And that's what they did in 1936. That was so successful in Egypt that Saudi Arabia decided to make the Huff's text that was chosen there in 1924 the official text for the entire world. Folks, that's 39 years ago. If any of you are listening, if you were around in 1985, you are older than the canonical text of the Quran. That makes you pretty old, doesn't it? But folks, before we go on, I want to say this. What has been the latest discoveries? And this is by far the most damaging, and this is the most exciting. I'm going to end with this. We're almost finished. Hold on. We're almost finished. This man here, he's a friend of mine. His name is Dr. Gunther Lunding. In 1970, he did his doctoral thesis in Germany on the beautiful poetry that he was finding in the Quran. And he said, I've seen this poetry before. It's gorgeous. Now, he's not only an Arabist, he's also a Syriac scholar. So he went back to the Syriac writings, and when he took off the vowels, when he took off the dots, remember you put dots and you put vowels on when you have only 16 letters? He took them off and went back to the Syriac documents, and guess what he found? He found that all of this beautiful poetry came from Christian hymns written in the 5th and 6th century. Eximum opus is the highest grade you can get in Germany. And he should have been given a professorship for getting that, for getting an eximum opus. He was thrown out of academia, down into obscurity. I found him in the 1990s, late 1990s. I went to his house, met his wife. I said, could you give me your doctorate? I brought it back to England, had it translated into English. There you can see it right there. You got Challenge to Islam for Reformation. You need to read the small print there. That's really what it's all about. Folks, that has resurrected him, has brought him back out of obscurity. Now his book has been so popular, and we're pushing it, that it's had to be reprinted. And that's why there's a new reprinting as of last year. It has destroyed what they had. Now, he died in 2014, a happy man. Because of what he did, Christoph Luxemburg, another German scholar, that's not his real name, that's a pseudonym, decided to go one step further. When you look at the Quran in Arabic today, about 25% of the Quran makes no sense in Arabic. And even the scholars don't know what to do with it. So he decided to do what Günther Luning did. He decided to go and take a look at what they call the dark passages. That's that 25%. He just wanted to find out what they said. And he looked at that and he started doing 7 different layers. He looked at the Al-Tabari's 10th century tafsir, couldn't help him. He looked at the Lisan al-Arab, which is the dictionary written by Ibn Manzur in 1290. That didn't help him. So he went to the homonyms and the pseudonyms in Aramaic. And suddenly he started finding a lot of similarities, a lot of homonymous words. So he took out the diacritics and put the Syriac diacritics back on. And then he went to look for Aramaic roots in these words using the different diacritics. He was then able to retranslate the Arabic words into Aramaics. And then using the 10th century Syro-Aramaic lexicon, he was able to reproduce the entire dark passages, all 25% of them. And guess what he found? Once he took the Arab Quran back to its Aramaic, Syro-Aramaic roots, all the dark passages that are missing were Christian lectionaries, Christian homilies, and Christian hymns all about Jesus Christ. It's all about Jesus. It had nothing to do with what they found, but who they found. Folks, this is exciting, which means if you take the Quran back to its original roots and take these dark passages and these beautiful poetry, the best part of the Quran, it's all about Jesus. Conclusion. And looking at the 4 periods of the textual evolution, 7th century, we have the Aramaic text that was taken over into Arabic. Once they did that, they had to start putting the dots and vowels where they wanted to in the 8th and 9th century. And that became started with the Arabic Ruzm manuscripts, which then became the Qira'at and the Ahruf diacritical problems, which created 700 Qurans by the 10th century, which then had to be whittled down to the 15th century down to 30, which then in the 20th century had to be whittled down to just 1, the Hafs text. So folks, can you see? Finally, remember the 4 claims I made about the Quran authority that Muslims claim, that it is eternal, sent down, complete, and unchanged, right? Remember those 4 claims I made at the very beginning? We pretty much shut those down, have we not, today, in just an hour and 20 minutes. What I'm going to do is, let's ask those 4, not of our Bible, because our Bible, we wouldn't make those 4 claims. I've said that at the very beginning. But we do have another word of God, do we not? His name is Jesus Christ, right? Wasn't Jesus also the Logos? In John 1, wasn't he also the Word of God? So let's apply him, our final revelation, our primary revelation, and let's ask, is Jesus eternal? Yes. Was Jesus sent down? Yes. Is Jesus complete? Absolutely. Has Jesus never changed? Absolutely. Thus, the 4 criteria Muslims are looking for in their Quran, their primary revelation, we already have in Jesus Christ, our primary revelation. Folks, we need to bring them home to a much greater and a much better revelation. Let's conclude. And here are my conclusions from everything I've said today. 4 areas that we looked at. Now, conclusion number 1. My remit really was to investigate both Mecca, Muhammad, and the Quran. When we look at the sources, it was obvious that everything Muslims are dependent on for their book man in place are based on traditions which are 200 to 300 years too late and hundreds of miles too far north. Mecca proved that probably the biggest problem for Muslims, the standard Islamic narrative refers to a place with much vegetation existing since the time of Adam and Eve and with 300 prophets buried there. Yet it's not referred to until 741, and none of the early maps show Mecca at all. Patricia Corona debunked the Montgomery Watts land-based trade route theory going back way back in 1987. We debunked the Red Sea trade route theory via Arabia, proving it was all via Africa because it had water. And all of the 7th century Qiblas were facing Petra up until 706 and not Mecca until 7. Actually, that should be 715. None of the surrounding empires ever heard of Mecca. And all of the stages of the Hajj were simply borrowed from other places, mostly Jerusalem. So, Muhammad, the coins proved that the area under Islam was either Christian or Zoroastrian until 692. The rock inscriptions proved that Islam, as we know, didn't appear until 730. All of the references for Muhammad are either too far north or refer to someone else who is the praised one. The Quran, the six earliest manuscripts prove that men created six different Qurans between the 7th and 9th century. The Birmingham folios prove that Muslims borrowed stories created long before the Quran. The 30 Qiraats, which proliferated between the 8th and 10th century, proved that Quran was evolving everywhere. Holding up the 26 Qiraats in 2016 at Speaker's Corner opened up a whole can of worms for Muslim scholars. The interview of June 8, 2020 created a platform for us to go public with the Qiraat narrative. And the 29 Qiraat variants dumped into the Nile in 1924 proved that when Muslims find problems with their Quran, they either burn them or wash them or erase them or cover them or sink them to destroy the evidence. Continuing on, the 4,000 consonant variants that Dan Brubaker has found created by Muslims showed that they accreted, deleted, and corrupted their text before standardizing it in the last century. The 63 fragments employed to just find 96% of the Quran proves they still cannot find a complete Quran for over 100 years, as the fragments are tentative or have not. The Aramaic Proto-Quran proves that when we go back to the original text, we find Jesus. Why are we surprised? Therefore, overview, what's going on? Between the 7th and 8th century, Arabs, in order to create their own distinct identity, they needed a book, they needed a man, they needed a place. Because we, as Christians and Jews, had a book, a man, and a place. So what did they do? In order to get the Quran, Muhammad, Mecca, they could not get him in 22 years. Therefore, they had to borrow. And that took centuries to do that, proving that Islam is as man-made as any other religion, unlike Christianity. We can use this material today to disprove the preservation of the Quran, Muhammad, and Mecca. It is Islam and not us who are arguing from science, as we now have the 7th century evidence that they don't have. These arguments hit at the very foundation of Islam, yet they are neutral and politically correct. The reason why this is so popular, and this is why so many people are asking me to use this all over the world. I just went to Nigeria to introduce it. I went to South Africa to use it. I was in Switzerland and then in Italy before that. I'm going to be heading off to Poland. We're going to be going to many places this next year because everybody wants it because it's, first of all, it's easy to use. It's visual. Notice that everything I have shown you today has to do with pictures of coins, rocks, buildings, maps, timelines, and manuscripts. Even speaking fast as I do, you still get the gist of what I'm saying. You don't have to know a word of Arabic to understand anything I've said today. Notice that. It is foundational to everything Muslims believe. Is one man, one book, one place, yet without any one of the three, Islam falls to pieces. That's why we're confronting all three. It is historically neutral and therefore not Islamophobic or hate speech. Thus, everyone can use it. Christians are the only ones who have a book, a man, and a place to respond to, basically to give them as an alternative. We are the only ones that understand the power of historical criticism. And therefore, we have the right to use it because it's already been used against us. We are the only ones who have a better response and a better solution. And who do you think his name is? His name is Jesus. Folks, that's why we need to use this material.